dopamine swipe, dopamine swipe, followers, likes, double tap. Now they control your life, control your
what is going on, beautiful people? Welcome back to the 817 podcast, where we talk about the lovely city of Fort Worth, Texas. We get into politics, business, culture, news, trends all across the city, the county, and the metroplex as a whole. This is probably going to be, Ann, my like favorite episode. Like, I can already feel it in my soul.
In our conversations about articles and talking about our guest.
Yeah, we have a really exciting guest for you guys this week. And that is County Commissioner Elisa Simmons, who's jumping onto the pod. And we got a lot to talk about with her. And she's been in the news with just all the incidents, what's happening with Judge Tim O'Hare. And him telling her to be quiet and people coming out to advocate for the, you know, disrespectfulness that occurred at that situation. So just a ton to talk about. And even the news itself, there was a ton of juicy news that we usually would get to if we didn't have a guest.
A lot of it was county focused, so probably have an opportunity to just dip into that with our guest as well.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. And so for those of you who maybe are listening because of County Commissioner Elisa Simmons and you're new to this, it is three short stories, one big story, and then wins and losses. Ann and I go through that every week, looking through different newspapers, different media outlets, and just figuring out what's the best thing we can give to local residents. Our idea is to be your Monday morning travel podcast to work so that you have a good synopsis of what to think about, what's going on in the city without having to pay a ton of subscriptions and do hours of reading. You know, in a 45 minute to an hour show, we can give you the goodies that you need. So let's go ahead and dive into short story one. And what do we got?
So short story number one is focusing on the West 7th area, which in the past we've dipped into a few stories of things that have happened in that area. But this one is focused, it's a Star-Telegram article entitled, "Should West 7th Property Owners Pay a Tax for Safety? How Fort Worth's Plan Would Work." And so this is basically describing what is called a public improvement district, which is a PID, P-I-D. And that is where property owners agree, and you have to get a certain percentage of people to buy into the idea before you can do it. And the city would assess a special tax on those property owners, and then that money would be reinvested in the specific boundaries of that area. So in the article, it describes the boundary of the public improvement district. They're typically defined by a process that involves local government authorities, property owners, and often public input as well. And this article shows those boundaries here. I always have issues with headlines that kind of are a hot take, you know, clickbaity. And I think this is kind of one of those because they're basically focusing on the tax for safety part of this. But thankfully, they do identify the fact that there are PIDs in other areas of the city, and they go into greater detail as to what a PID is typically used for. The West 7th area has talked about this for many, many years. There's several entities in that area that have, you know, some folks have been in agreement about doing a PID and some have not. The Crockett Row, which is now called Artisan Circle. And before Crockett Row, it was called West 7th, just, you know, generically. And so people were never sure exactly what area people were talking about. But that Artisan Circle is kind of the developed area that's mixed use, that has its own parking garages and is along Crockett Street through the middle of it, and has already done a lot of the infrastructure improvements. So landscaping, street lighting, wider sidewalks, walkability, all that was kind of part of their redevelopment. And so in the past, the owners of that part of the area were not really interested in paying into a PID. They were a major property owner. They felt like they'd already kind of put all those improvements in, so they didn't see the benefit for themselves. But the new owners of that area, who have renamed it Artisan Circle, my understanding, they are on board with this idea. And in my opinion, I think it is a good idea. And it's not just for safety. It is for improving infrastructure at some point, because this tax is collected over time And it all gets reinvested back into the boundaries of this area.
Now, you mentioned the target group and others are not. You just kind of said some are not interested.
Yeah. But. So in this article, it said that it would not apply to Montgomery Plaza Park Shopping Center after property owners of Target and Kimco Realty had opted out of the district, which I think is, I mean, I haven't talked to them recently. I had been in touch with most of these people when I was serving on the city council because it is in District 9. And I think that's short-sighted. I think they should participate. I think that the entire area could benefit from this. And it would bring together a more cohesive entity over the whole area, because up to this point, there have been the Cultural District Alliance in this area. There has been the West 7th Residents, which is mainly made up of people who live in for sale product, so condos, but not people who live in apartments. And then there's the Bar Association. So when this all flared up, and a lot of this safety conversation has been centered around activities coming out of the bar development in the area, the Bar Association, when I was in office, I tried to encourage them to become part of the Cultural District Alliance. And I tried to encourage residents that started the West 7th Residents Association to be part of a group where everybody could kind of come together and try to work through these things together. But because they were often at odds about what they thought the solutions were, they were hesitant to do that. And so I think that is partially why things continue to be not as collaborative as one would hope they
could. Yeah, and it feels like that, right? You can be in Doc's Records and over there in this like weird, you know, warehouse kind of development sector. And
yeah, they call that the Foundry District.
Yeah, and then you go up to Montgomery Plaza, and then you go over to West 7th, and then you go over to the Culture District, and it's all, you know, it's all relatively close, but it all doesn't feel cohesive.
Yeah, and Councilwoman Beck indicated that she's been trying to get this done since she took office, and I think that you know, it's a good effort that she's trying to work on, and I wholly support it and think that it would be in the benefit of the whole area. But I think that there's a couple people who are saying, you know, this is not going to go towards things that'll fix us because the focus at the beginning is going to be on this safety, starting off with paying for ambassadors. It was good to see that I think they did touch on the fact that there are public improvement districts in other areas of the city. And if you look at where those exist, you'll see that those are pretty successful districts. So downtown Fort Worth has one, the near South Side has one. And that, you know, those dollars go back into making improvements in those areas. You asked me before we started recording if I had any kind of hot takes on how West 7th, that whole area, has developed. And I will say that
I said, give me a grade on your urban planning grade for West 7th.
But so you're laying it.
I know. I know you're
grade.
Not going to give it. I know you're not going to give it a grade because you're not going to do that to them.
It's hard to be. I mean, it's easy to be like 2020 vision, looking back, what shoulda, coulda done to not get us into this situation. But I think one of the things that lended to there being development that isn't necessarily the best kind of urban core development is that this is a mixed use district, and the city of Fort Worth has an allowance where somebody can do a development that is not mixed use within their specific piece of property if there are a mix of uses in the vicinity. And many of those large scale bars that were kind of adaptively reusing industrial spaces to make large, high occupancy bars, they don't have a mix of uses in their individual developments. And they were able to do that in a mixed use area because of the proximity rule that allowed them to say, well, there's a mix of uses within proximity of this, so we don't need to have a mix of uses in our specific development. And that's what led to the proliferation of those large bars being able to go in by right. And so I think that had they required mixed use everywhere, we would have gotten not as many of those large occupancy bars, which in my opinion are causing the need for the safety, because there was an article also that touched on safety. And I think there were some hot takes from people about it's the mix of guns and alcohol.
Yeah.
So
And then you also, but I would imagine the whole parking dynamic and like how horrible it is to just even like get over to that area.
So let me just tell you that I don't agree with you on that. There are ways to get over there that don't even get you mired up in traffic, even if it's a really congested time. Yeah. Like when West 7th was under construction.
You don't agree there's a crazy parking over in West 7th?
I think that you have to know the rules about that. You, if you go to the Artisan Circle businesses, you can park in those parking garages and you can get
the coin,
the validation, it's free if you're going to those businesses. If you're going to one of the adaptively reused industrial buildings that are now a bar,
10 feet
that from, don't have any parking, you have to know that if you park on the street, there are now meters. Yeah. But half the time, those meters are giving you 2 hours of free parking. So if you pull up the app and try to park and pay, it'll tell you.
I would love to know the percentage of under 30-year-old Fort Worthians who has had a ticket from West 7th downtown area. It has to be probably 15 to 20% because it's always...
I'm really holding myself back here right now because I'm like, if you can't figure out the rules by reading the signs, having the app, then I think you deserve a ticket.
Yeah, there you go.
They've also gone to the trouble to add parking over in the Farrington Field area. So if you're going to a bar, you can go park and there then, for $10 and you can go have the run of the entire area. Yeah. And you can Uber and Lyft, which you should be doing if you're drinking.
Yes, that is also a kicker.
And there is public transportation on West 7th Street that comes every 7.5 minutes at the moment because there's the Dash and there's also the route number 2. So I have hot takes about parking.
But people bring all those big bars, every single person's in a single occupancy driving there. And so it's, you know, me and you might just need to go out one night, you know, act young, you know, we should go just, you know, cause
ruckus. Oh, like so that. There was somebody in the Fort Worth Weekly that went and did some bar hopping in the West 7th area and then had some hot takes on it. And, I don't really.
So, and so the story I want to bring up is from March 30th. It was a little later. We missed this because we were doing a lot of guests, interviews. But this is I want to get your take on this whole, which Fort Worth Entertainment District has the most crime? Here's what we found out. Out of 3,197 crimes reported in Fort Worth, 5 entertainment districts from January 1st, 2023 to March 2024, the largest number, 40%, happened in West 7th area, totaling 1,288, according to the city data obtained by Star Telegram. The downtown area followed West 7th district for crimes reported in approximately 14-month period, with a total of 970 calls to police. The city reported 650 crimes in Stockyards, 198 in South Main, and 91 in the Magnolia area. Those are our 5 areas of entertainment. What was interesting is the types of crimes. For instance, in Magnolia, there was different types of crimes. Mainly, they had 8 reported assaults, assault by threat, 1 aggravated assault, 2 Class Cs. Again, only 91 compared to 1,300 of West 7th. South Main's was theft. There was 28 thefts, burglaries out of vehicles, 29. But again, not that many when you look at the whole. Stockyards, theirs was mainly assault came as mostly common reported. But when you really get to where what I'm trying to get to is the part that separated it was in West 7th. Here was West 7th's data. It said 136 theft calls, 104 assault calls, 22 aggravated assault calls. But here was the crazy one. Most reports of narcotic violations, 122. And then the other big part of this was last year, police officers confiscated more than 100 guns in the area. Police have taken more proactive approach since September 2022 by increasing traffic stops. And I guess if you... with the goal of finding illegal guns and drugs. While Texas is a constitutional carry state, it's illegal to possess a gun while committing another crime. Most of the guns confiscated in West 7th District comes from traffic stops where police smell marijuana. That to me is I don't ever want to hang out in West 7th. If you're talking about, if there's 365 days and there's 100 guns being confiscated in an area where people are drinking, getting in confrontations, fighting over parking, you know, I just, what's your take on this kind of?
I mean, going back to stuff? what what I talked about before, a true mixed-use district. You can see that near Southside is a true mixed-use district. So it's not just a place where people are going to go to high-occupancy bars and drink. Yeah. And so while it's an entertainment district, there's restaurants and ice cream places and places that families go and all of that. And I think that there are parts of West 7th that have that too. And the Crockett Row, now Artisan Circle area, had that. But I think it's just been overwhelmed by this people going there to drink. And you can't even take weapons into bars that have over the 51%. Like, yeah. Those signs are everywhere. So people, I think, are keeping these things in their cars, which is even more terrifying.
Yeah. And my unexperienced opinion of all of this is, I think this is what happens in Fort Worth or in Texas when you allow, like, just capitalism to do what capitalism does, and people just... when you don't have a lot of government rules, because people are proud of Fort Worth being so easy to build, but then you can just build a bunch of bars and you can just build a bunch of cheap stuff. And then we deal with the consequences afterwards.
And those bars are bringing in a lot of tax dollars,
yeah.
Because the alcohol sales is, you know, a high tax revenue. And so It's not like they're in
But isn't that crazy? Most of the things that bring in tax dollars is things that's bad for, like, humanity, like drinking and driving and lotto tickets. And
I think it's easier to tax people on those things because they're considered vices. And so you don't get as much pushback from folks saying, no, don't tax me on that because it's a punishment for a vice.
My people on the east side, they're very like, well, we got a bunch of people we need some safety and resources over here because every weekend there's gunshots and things going on. And we're finding, if you look at, you know, where the cases are of, like, high, you know, drugs being found, it's over in our area. And they're all like, hey, we want resources, but everything's going to this resource where a bunch of kids go party because it makes, like you said, the money. You know, it's, if you look at the places that are most police, it's also the places where most people with money attend to, right? The three top places on this list was downtown, Stockyards, and West 7th. Anytime someone says where I live is dangerous, I'm going to be like, well, you're technically more dangerous in West 7th apartment that you're paying $2,200 more than my mortgage, because you want to go hang out in the cool places. And technically, you're more dangerous than over where I live. So it doesn't, like, I just love how it's like, we always say the bad areas, and technically the bad areas are the places where everyone hangs out that is actually spending money.
And while I think it's super important to talk about all these things, I just hope that the good idea of the PID doesn't get lost in all of this other angst and upsetness about what it's going to be used for. Because I think in the long run, ambassadors that they're adding are not just to do safety stuff. They are to help people find their way around. They have, in the downtown ambassadors, they have folks that touch base with people experiencing homelessness and try to help connect them to services. So while there's a whole lot of focus on the negativity about all this, I think that it is an effort that the city has underway that, while if we had done, you know, X, Y, and Z in the beginning, we wouldn't find ourselves in this position. We find ourselves in this position, and this is a tool that could make it better.
Yeah. Love it. Well, we spent a lot of time on short story number one. Let's go dive into short story number two. Short story number two. We are going to talk about Fort Worth ISD could close these seven middle schools. Here's what we know. The district held a series of community listening sessions over the past 2 weeks to talk about the possibility of consolidating seven middle schools. The meetings are a part of a larger facilities study that is expected to result in school closures. Some of the listening sessions have grown contentious, with some attendees saying Fort Worth ISD leaders haven't done enough to keep the broader community informed about the decision process. District leaders emphasize that no decision has been made and encourages parents and other community members to voice their concerns through the district's website. Fort Worth ISD is eyeing these middle schools. The design presented during the community listening sessions aren't firm, building plans, but the district contracted with architects to do feasibility studies, preliminary work looking at whether there's enough physical space to build combined campuses at the sites the district is eyeing. In the Pasco High School area, district officials are considering consolidating McLean 6th grade, McLean Middle School, and Daggett Middle School into a single campus. In Northside High School area, the district is looking at combining J.B. Elder and Kirkpatrick Middle School into a single campus. And in the Polytechnic High School area, the district is considering combining William James and Morningside Middle Schools. Any campuses districts decided to consolidate won't see the changes until 2027-2028 school year. All seven campuses on the list of possible consolidations were slated for upgrades as a part of the $1.2 billion bond issues voted and narrowly passed in November 2021.
So, you know, my understanding is that a while back, the Fort Worth ISD did a bond to improve high schools, and all of those high schools that were in that bond, those improvements were made. And now that the bond has passed to make improvements to all of these middle schools, and there's a combination of things at play here. There has been declining enrollment, and so some of these schools don't have as many kids in them. And, you know, financially, it doesn't make sense necessarily to have all of them stay open. So the first question that I had several people asking me about in some of these discussions was, is it even legal for them to change what people voted on in a bond? Can they take money from a school that people thought was going to get improved with those bond dollars and consolidate it to build a new campus? My assumption would be that legally they've looked into this and they've figured out that they can, because I don't even know why you would start the conversation if you couldn't legally do that. On a note of there's two things that I am concerned about, and that is just the acquiescing to the idea that Fort Worth ISD is going to continue to decrease in student population. And just, you know, we're going to go from 80,000 students that we used to have down to 50,000s, and that we should just take that and, you know, all these charter schools are going to be opening up and continue to take students away from Fort Worth ISD, and that we're just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller when our population is growing and growing and growing. So that's one thing. The other thing is mega campuses and whether that is in the best interest of student outcomes. I didn't go to any of these meetings, but I know people who did, and some of the questions that they had were more around, is this in the best interest of student outcomes? And then the other question is, are these designs that you're proposing, that these architects that have put together, going to fit within the urban environment? Because most of these schools are in the urban core of the city, and some of them have some historicness to them. And so what happens to those? Are they going to be adaptively reused into something else? And how the new campuses are built, and how does that interact with the neighborhood? There's a lot of focus on safety, and, you know, having entrances where people come and go and all of that. So the only thing is, I think some of these presentations came across as a foregone conclusion that we've already decided that this is what we're going to do. And I think many of the people that attended them were like, we'd like to see the process by which you came to this conclusion. And if we agree, that's fine. But the transparency piece, as they put in this article, is part of what they're asking for. Just if you have had experts delve into all this and you have come to this conclusion, show us how you got from here to there. And don't just come with the, here's the mega campus we're going to build in place of these three campuses that currently exist.
My take on it is that we're definitely going to have to close some schools. Like just mathematically sustaining what we do. But I also think we can look at it more of an opportunity, right? Like And I understand this happens all the time. Like I do an innovative approach in education and people ask me about research, but a lot of times the issue with education research is it takes like 10 years to study the outcomes. And then what happens is everyone goes, oh, let's do this research study. And then they do this research study and they realize, whoa, one-to-one laptops provide equitably the technology and we need to give every single kid a laptop. And do you know what happens? They're on their phones because you didn't see where the world was going, and they don't use these billions of dollars of laptops that we all invested in because we missed the mobile wave of technology because we're so focused on doing what the research told us to do, but the research only can research the present. You can't research the future. And so you're kind of making trends. And so I think how do we look at new school? Because there's positives in a mega school. A lot of these suburban areas have become powerhouses and successful because of the strategy of having one school in their communities. Now, also, these other big parts is that that limits the bus. Like it allows you to bring teachers together. It allows you to reduce that. It allows you to reduce bus routes. It allows you to like really mainstream that. Plus, you're looking at today where nearly 30% of kids are chronically absent. So you're also dealing with just like, it's not just that there's less enrollment, there's less kids showing up to class. And then teacher absenteeism is also high. So you're dealing with a lot of, you need bigger rooms, you need bigger stuff. We're already, because of just the behaviors of a post-pandemic world where people aren't in physical spaces Monday to Friday because their endurance is different. So how do you now create school? Yeah, you might have a mega building, but you're now making school more agile where a kid, you know, is, you know, doing field trips or whatever, and you're more out of the school, or the parents are taking the kids out to do something else, and bringing school in a more fluid way where you spend less on physical buildings. We got to get out of the JCPenney blockbuster mindset, and our old school districts are the only thing standing where Kmart and Sears and all the other things that were around them are gone. And it's because they realize that this doesn't work anymore. And so, unfortunately, we have to have bigger schools. We just have to in order to survive in today's world.
And just from an urban planning perspective, when you have those big suburban style schools in the middle of an urban environment, you are going to have problems with circulation and traffic when you don't have a robust multimodal transit system that allows people to get to school in other ways besides single occupancy vehicles.
Yeah, and a lot of schools in other areas like Philadelphia ISD, kids take the regular bus. They don't even have the school bus.
Yeah. When I'm in D.C., I see kids on the subway all the time going to class on their own.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was at Main Street Arts Festival on Thursday afternoon, and there were a ton of Young Women's Leadership Academy students walking around the art fair with clipboards doing some kind of assignment. And they are located in downtown Fort Worth, and then they can avail themselves of kind of cool activity in the urban core of our city. So I want schools in the urban core of our city. I just want them to be sensitive to the environment in which they're in and not just plunk a suburban school into the middle of an urban neighborhood.
Yeah. I love it. Awesome. Cool. Well, let's go to story number three. Story number three was really interesting. I saw this on Instagram, and then I read the story. I thought it was a good article. It said, rally gathers in downtown Fort Worth to bring awareness to unsolved cold cases. Relatives to about 1,000 cold cases that are being investigated at Fort Worth Police Department, only 6 have been solved, according to the Fort Worth PD Cold Case Support Group. About 1,000 cold cases, only 6 solved. And you're wondering why such a low close rate. Well, notable solved cases in Fort Worth, we remember like the big ones, right? Like the Kara Walker and Melissa Highsmith. Walker was 17 when she was kidnapped, raped, and killed by Glenn McCurley in 1974. McCurley was sentenced to life in 2021. And then Highsmith's case was kidnapped as a baby in Fort Worth in 1971 and was reunited with their family in November 22. We remember diving into that one. So, but what here's the power is that you have more families out there who are fighting for this situation, and Fort Worth PD only has one officer for all the cold cases. And so a lot of families, I believe we needed to talk about this because we need to see where the people are moving. And if people are out actually still to this day doing a rally, showing awareness to this problem, clearly we're showing that this is an issue. And it's so much of an issue that there's a nonprofit that solely focuses on collecting donations that go directly to the cold cases. And there's one detective assigned to the whole unit. And I just think that's like, I don't know. I just feel like that is like an area where if I was trying to be a cop, I feel like this would be an easy way to recruit people to do the job on like cold cases and investigating these complex situations that people have given up on. I don't know why this would be a hard thing to recruit for and spend energy on. If I was trying to be a cop doing good in the community, this seems like a part being an investigative crime reporter in a way. Like, it's sad that our investigative cold cases, Star Telegram has more people doing it than our Fort Worth PD.
And I wonder what other cities have, like what is the a number that other cities have in this arena? Because, you know, my oldest child majored in chemistry and it was forensic chemistry that he majored in. So like you said, being able to draw people to research these things and work in this area would probably be interesting to young people. And those are the kind of things as technology changes and DNA stuff can be done and different things can be done with evidence that was collected back in the day. Maybe there's an ability to solve some of these cases if you put some more people in those roles. So I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know why this – I think that for most people, they look at police funding as wanting to fund things that are going to keep them safe today. Yeah. And so this small – not so small group of folks that have continued to be impacted by crimes of the past is something that is interesting to be highlighted, and hopefully something will come from this.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can't just say 98% of those cases, there isn't some type of thing we're getting wrong. Like, there's another one of these Walkers or Highsmith cases happening, and for a family to not know that could be their situation is just like... You know,
I think when crimes happen, people are always looking for reasons why it wouldn't be them.
Yeah, 100%.
Just so that they can, you know, not feel as anxious about it.
Yeah. So that was short story number three. We're now going to go ahead and dive into the big story. The big story we have today is with Alisa Simmons. Alisa Simmons is a devoted public servant invested in improving community access to government services in the area of transportation, affordable housing, criminal justice, economic development, and other critical issues. We're probably going to dive into each of those topics. We have a list of county stories to go through with her, get her take. Commissioner Simmons is a proud mother, entrepreneur, and community advocate. She graduated from Texas Women's University with a degree in journalism and was a journalist for 12 years before transitioning into a career of public safety, where she spent 22 years as a county 911 administrator, supporting dispatch operations of all Tarrant County EMS, police, fire departments. So Commissioner Simmons runs her own business. She is a HUB certified entrepreneur. Outside of her professional career, she also has her leadership with frequent groups. For instance, she served on the Arlington Comprehensive Plan Advisory Committee, the Chisholm Trail chapter of the American Red Cross Board of Directors, a 10-year member of the YMCA Arlington Board, president of the Arlington NAACP, first vice president of Texas NAACP. Again, why I love this as well is because she is adjacent to Fort Worth. So we're going to also get to learn a lot about Arlington and the dynamics of them into the Metroplex. And so let's bring on Commissioner Alisa Simmons.
Well, thank you both for having me today. Let's see, my Tarrant County story is, so I worked for the Tarrant County 911 district for 18 years. And I was the public information officer for 18 years. And so that gave me an opportunity to get to know every municipality, every city in Tarrant County, from Hazel to Haltom City to White Settlement. And so I have served those cities in the provisioning and maintenance of their 911 networks, their systems. And the super fun part of that job was doing public outreach, community outreach, public education, going into schools or having my volunteers who are 911 dispatchers and call takers go into schools to teach kids about the 911 system, to teach senior citizens about how to use cell phones. Remember when cell phones came about and there was no location when you dial 911. So that was a huge undertaking. And just the technological advancements that came along with the proliferation of cell phone usage for everybody. So that was really my Tarrant County story. prior to that, I worked for a radio station, KNOK. I don't know if you all might be too young to remember that. KNOK was an urban contemporary station. It was here in Fort Worth. It was headquartered here.
Oh, cool.
And I did the news. So I graduated from Texas Women's University, would listen to that station, driving back and forth between classes from my apartment to campus. And I heard this young man doing the news, and he would do the afternoon news. The news director would do the morning news. And I always thought, I'm better than him.
That's awesome.
I can do better than Dexter. And he was always a good friend after that. And so I just called back then. All I knew to do was call the request line. You know, they never picked that up. And then one day they did. And I said, hey, I want to do y'all's news. And they said, you have to talk to Robert Ashley. And they gave me a regular phone number. I called him, drove to Fort Worth, terrified because I'm a little older. And there was no GPS or anything like that back then.
Mapsco.
I didn't even know about Mapsco. So I drove from Denton to Fort Worth, which seemed like it was, you know, a long, 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 long way. And got to Fort Worth, and they didn't answer the door. It was some holiday. And I was like, oh, my God. And I drove back to Denton without having talked to him. But eventually talked to him, got an internship, and they went, oh, my God, you have a fabulous voice. And then I took somebody's job. And so worked for that radio station for 12 years and left there, went to KRLD in Dallas, where I worked the afternoon assignment desk. So I was not on air at KRLD. I was more into my news. I wanted to grow with regard to news writing and producing, and worked there and worked at WFAA as a writer. And so that's my kind of Tarrant County, Fort Worth story.
So did you grow up here at all?
No.
Where's home? Like, where did you grow up?
Austin.
Austin, cool.
Born and raised in Austin. Graduated in 81, high school in 81, and went to Texas Women's University in Denton. Graduated there in 85.
And then you've stayed
and just kind of settled here in the area. Met my former husband, and we landed in Arlington, and that's where we raised our kids and all that good stuff. Married 18 years. We still co-parent quite nicely, even though these kids are adults.
You're never done being a parent.
But you're always
my kids
a parent.
Are adults too. And
yes,
absolutely.
So we get along just fine.
Right.
So
how'd you get into this, you know, politics and participating and just getting to the position
running
you are today?
For office. Yeah. What made you run for office? I get that question quite a bit as someone who has done
that
too.
So, raised the boys. I was always an active and involved parent, room parent for both boys, both schools. I'll be the head room parent. I always wanted to be the room parent in charge. And so my kids were in private school, then transitioned them to public school when the oldest was 5th grade was his first year in public school. So I was definitely going to be a watchdog there.
Middle school can be a challenging time.
Yeah. And so just always been active and engaged on PTA boards and kind of graduated from that to school district committees, site-based decision-making, workforce diversity, textbook adoption. So did those committees, then went on to city committees and community boards, the Parenting Center of Tarrant County and Chisholm Trail Chapter of Red Cross, City's Comprehensive Plan Commission, Chairman of the Library Board. So just all of that busybody activity.
I think that is all incredibly important work to then run for office? Because yes. I think that is the kind of engagement and involvement in a community that makes someone be a great representative of
right.
the people.
You see, you know, you kind of see the sausage making and you go, what are they doing? Mm-hmm. Or I think I can offer some insight here. So did that. And, of course, professional association boards. I worked for in public safety communication for the 911 district. And so I served as president of the state 911 professional association and the state 911 public educators association on FCC committees and different appointments and things like that. So just like to be a part of whatever I'm doing. So not just go to work.
Yeah.
I like to do more than that. And so I think my largest volunteer role, though, has been as president of the Arlington NAACP. So I did that 10 years or 12 years, long, hard years. And so that has been, I would say, the most impactful role that I have had. And so I got to, you know, at this point, I'm tired of asking for people to consider those who are considered the least of us. I need to be in a position where I can make some policy decisions, change some laws, make some just change practices and processes. I have always had a big heart for people who feel like they don't have a voice, people who don't know where to turn to get solutions. I'm going to know what to do. If I don't know, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to help you. I don't care what color you are. I don't care how much money you have or how much money you don't have. I can't be standing in line at the post office waiting to go to the counter and overhearing somebody's conversation about some issue, and I'm sitting there. I have solved it. I have solved it for them. And so I just have to be not so nosy to say, hey, let me tell you what you need to do. And that's how I am. I'm going to help anybody who seems to be at a loss.
You know, EJ always gets on my case when I say to somebody that they're saying the same things that, like, tie it back to myself. Mm-hmm. But I hear so much of my election story and why I ran for office as well, because people came to me and were like, you seem to know how to get things done in the city. You should be making some of these policy decisions.
That's right.
And so I'm not
making. And I can see you stopping someone at the grocery store solving their problems. So that felt right, you know?
Yeah.
It felt really right.
Yeah. And I've done it before. I try not to.
And then with social media, there's all kinds of opportunities to chime in when are complaining about things, that the struggles that they're finding and answers that they can't find a solution for and wanting to fix all of their problems. And doing that at a citywide level is big enough. But Tarrant County.
Oh, yeah.
So much larger, but your background with having served in that 911 capacity for all of those communities, mm-hmm. it seems like you would be very familiar going into this role.
Yeah, well, you think so, but I got here and learned a lot more and continue to learn a lot more. And, you know, first thing I did was sat down with every department head, you know, sat down with all my mayors in Southeast Tarrant County, which I knew most of them.
And how many is that roughly?
It's six. Okay. So Precinct 2 encompasses Arlington, Mansfield, Kennedale, Dow Worthington Gardens, Pantego, and the Tarrant County portion of Grand Prairie. So all those city managers met with all of them. And then I started meeting with department heads, elections, public health, HR, housing, all of the county's department heads. And each meeting, I would become upset because this county offers so many services And I'm like, how? People don't know about this. I've been the NAACP. I know everything. But you don't, right? I really don't know everything. But why didn't I know that we're still giving housing assistance to people who are having trouble paying their rent? Why didn't I know that? And I said, it's on our website. And I'm like, that busybody, old-fashioned county website, somebody's supposed to just go on
and find it there.
If they're struggling with their rent and know to go to the county. So there are so many inefficiencies in this county that it is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a natural edit, guys. I didn't edit that part. That was just a natural edit. So.
Well, it's funny because we had Bud Kennedy on as a guest the other day, mm-hmm. and he made a comment basically saying that county government is kind of inefficient in its,
God.
That's the way it's set up to be. So it's very interesting to hear you describe, you know, that you went and researched all this to find out and dive into mm-hmm. and found this. When I first started serving on the city council, I had my county commissioner reach out to me and say, I've got some dollars for roads mm-hmm. that are in the county or can be in the city too, you know, and I didn't know that right. was a thing
yeah.
and how it went about. And so that seemed inefficient to me. So it's... that was one of our questions, was kind of what should people know about how the county works? Because for many years, I think that people didn't even really know when the county commission met and that they could go to those meetings.
y'all, these people still pay their claims or invoices. They pay their bills with checks. I mean, everything is electronic. You can transfer funds and pay the county's FedEx bill. You don't have to write checks. You don't. I've been to enough conferences and walking through the vendor halls and seeing the vendors that offer these types of services. I mean, it is just unbelievable how inefficient. This county operates, how inefficiently it operates. And to their credit, now, you know that when I came in, Commissioner Ramirez and Judge O'Hare, we all came in at the same time. And we all three saw that, you know, it was, you know, we can't all three talk on the phone at the same time, but in individual conversations, I'm like, did you know? And the other one would go, oh my God, can you believe? So there are inefficiencies there. There are things we could coalesce around if we would focus on those things and not be so partisan, you know, and we can make some improvements here.
Yeah. I would love to get, what would be your, like, if you could just talk to the people about, like, how the current state of county leadership and, you know, what we need to be aware about how county is working. Like, what would you say today? I know there's a lot in the news today about what's going on past a certain meeting. But just overall in the back end, you know, it seems like you guys can agree on some things that inefficiencies, but it seems like the politics are getting away to maybe focus on those things.
Yeah, again, that's unfortunate. I think we could, you know, serve more people and serve them better if that were our focus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my focus. It's Commissioner Brooks' focus. But the most powerful person on the court, and let me be very clear, he's only powerful. Judge O'Hare is only the most powerful person on the court because he has 3 votes. That's it. It's not because of a title, because county judge is a ceremonial title. y'all know there's
his job is just to preside over the meeting. Yeah, you all have equal votes.
He just moderates the meeting. Yeah. That's it. So folks need to be clear that 254 counties in Texas, I believe they all have a commissioner's court in Texas that consists of 5 members, 4 commissioners, and a county judge. Constitutionally, all 5 have the exact same amount of power. The county judge can alone declare an emergency, like a burn ban. That does not have to come before court for approval, or declare a COVID emergency. The county judge alone can declare an emergency. The county judge can replace a commissioner in the event I go out here and get hit by a T-bus or something. He can.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Especially not me. Okay. Yeah. So if somebody steps down the county judge, that's all. But
and is that for until the next election?
Yes, until the next election. Okay. So other than that, a county judge has no more authority than a commissioner. That's it. So people need to know that. What makes him powerful, again, is that he has 3 votes. And, I'm going to take back a little bit of what I said. He's not the most powerful person up there. The most powerful person, in my estimation, is Commissioner Ramirez or Commissioner Ficus, whichever one chooses to be the swing. But if you probably don't pay attention, of course, I'm there. They acquiesce to whatever the judge wants. They hear this, they may become upset about it, but they vote 95-98% of the time the way the judge wants them to vote, or the way the judge votes. And so either one of those gentlemen could be the most powerful person on commissioner's court, but for whatever reason they acquiesce.
One would hope that they would be listening to their own constituents and making decisions based on kind of the research that you described, that you do when you're looking at what is in the best interest of the county as a whole and your precinct. So that's unfortunate.
And one of those examples of this is the incident that happened was that earlier this week? It already feels like
I know.
It feels like a long time ago.
It was a long week for me.
I know how many people have talked about it, but that was all about what seemed to be something where a 5-month, $1,000 a month contract, which you and Roy Brooks voted no against because it seemed like it was a political contract that we were going to now use public dollars to service. There was, I guess, it got heated between the two of you, and he kind of said some words.
Rude
words that got people sit there and be quiet. I'm talking kind of information as if he could, talk to anyone like that in 2024. But so this seems like an example where you did everything to do to keep it accountable, but that 3-2 vote still allowed that to pass, even though the news is that the news is how he talked to you, but the news isn't even about, people aren't even realizing that we just passed dollars to fund political campaigns.
Yes. I can handle myself. But you're right. People miss the story. We just took taxpayer dollars. I don't care if it's a fucking penny. And we're paying it to somebody whose business is political consulting. And we're bringing them on to the county to help him do his job policy-wise and with PR. There's nothing wrong. I'm a career PR person, communications person. But he has a director of policy and communications in his office that makes somewhere around $130,000 a year. And so for the county to bring in somebody whose business is explicitly being a Republican campaign consultant is wrong. That's not what taxpayer dollars should be used for. And I said that very simply. You all haven't jumped on me and, you know, told me to shut up and, you know, sit down and I will listen to you. I'm a 60-year-old woman. I did my research on this. The public came and spoke on it. Commissioner Brooks's comments, if you listened, were a lot harsher than what I said. I think my comments were rather milquetoast compared to what Commissioner Brooks said. And somehow he looks right past Commissioner Brooks and decides to jump me. What if you, you know, just do any research on me or talk to anybody, especially in Arlington, it can be, you know, rank and file community members or the police chief, the city manager, the mayor, the superintendent. I'm not easily bullied. I'm very direct. I'm a nice person, but I'm going to say what I've got to say. You get what you get with me. I'll be professional, polite, but you push me, I push back. I told Judge O'Hare that in our very first meeting. I said, we can go out here and perform for these people or we can serve this county. I said, but I will tell you, you push me, I push back. Okay? And so that was a warning I gave. We first went to lunch, first week of in office.
Arriving there together, both yes. new yeah. to the position.
Yeah, because when we spoke on the phone, he called and said, we probably need to get together. I said, yeah, we need to go do lunch. I think it was our first day, like January 2nd. And he says, I know we're not going to get along. I know we're not going to agree on anything. And I was like, whoa, 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 how do you know? How do you know? You already know. And so we had that conversation on the phone and went to lunch and stayed about 2 hours. I said, come over to Arlington, and came to the sub courthouse, got in my car, took him to lunch. And talked about some things. He asked a couple of things that might make you laugh mm-hmm. or your mouth open up. He asked, are you sure you're not a Republican? I said, I guarantee you I'm not a Republican. Because we talked about what issues were important yeah. to us. No, I'm not a Republican. And the other thing he asked was, are you woke? I said, yeah, I'm woke. I said,
educated, informed, wanting to do the right you. Thing.
I really so know how much they ruined that word.
I know, it's really word. Sad.
They really have. I said, I would contend you're woke too. I'm not woke. I said, I bet you are. I think you are. You're engaged. You know what's happening in your yeah. community. You care.
Yeah.
And so I think you're woke.
Yeah.
So it was just a yeah. one-on-one conversation in our first meeting.
You also talked about how he he directed it to you, even though Brooks's comments were harsher, and I also seen in a couple of the articles, and even when we watch you in the meeting, that you feel like you don't get the information ever correctly when all the other commissioners get it. Can you kind of give the context of like that dynamic?
Yeah. So, you know, get elected and you walk in your first day and everybody's, Hi, Commissioner. And I'm like, oh, wow. Thought it was Elisa.
Fancy title.
Yeah, but I'm, you know.
You'll be so the honorable for the rest of your life now that you've been elected. Oh, you know that?
I did know that. Thank you. Yeah. I didn't. And so, and I almost started telling people, just call me Elisa. But, I, you know, it took me a minute to catch on to the culture of the county. And so just let them do that and just get used to it. And so, I learned very quickly, and I tell people this is not a job like, I don't know, school board or city council where you, I don't know, you get to come in, sit down, spend a year learning and getting you. No, this is a job you sit down. They're like, this city is looking at $28 million. We need you to sign this contract because it was approved by your, and I'm like, huh, what? Who?
Yeah.
Nope, can't sign anything. It's $28 million. I need to know what it is and understand. So this is a job where you jump in and you are working. Yeah. And but I started getting accustomed to the culture, and you know, I would Google or wonder how much they spent on this or that. All you have to do is but ask, and voila, it is produced. County staff will give commissioners, court members, anything, any data, anything. They know it. They get it to you quickly. And so I've become accustomed to that in this first year in office and so forth. And just after our previous county administrator resigned, G.K. Manius, I had a request for some jail data. Say this was October, and today is April, and I still don't have it. It's very basic jail data. So if I'm trying to make a case for something fiscally, generally is where I'm going, I need the information so I can make an informed decision. I'm not here to attack or denigrate the sheriff or I'm trying to make improvements, right? So I need the information so that me and my team can do that. So I'm still waiting for some data from October. I'm still waiting for some other data. It's really public information. It's for those counties that have a public dashboard, it's out there. So this other information, I don't even want names of these inmates. I just want data going 5 years back. I think I made that request in December or January. It is April. I did not have it. The DA's office has told me I have to submit a Rule 12 request, whatever the heck that is. So I've done that. They've come back, and that has been the criminal court administrative judge said that's not his call. The DA told me it was his call. It's not his call. So he sent it to some other judges. They've written back and said there's no reason to withhold that data. It's available to you. That was last week. Sent that to the administrator and the DA. They have written back saying they can't give me the data. People, I am a county commissioner asking for public data that if you look at Bexar County's website, Dallas County's website, it's sitting there.
Not here in Tarrant County.
It's we don't have, our public dashboard is trash, or we don't have one. Yeah. So I need the data. I am a county, I am a duly elected appointing authority of the state of Texas. And so those are the roadblocks I am up against. And if you watched last meeting, the question about the pre-numbered election paper stock or stock versus the unnumbered stock, and if you saw that line of questioning to the assistant DA that represents the commissioner's court, and his resistance, just sheer resistance to answer a simple question. Question was, the question has been answered. It was answered and closed. The question was, does Clint Ludwig, our county elections administrator, does he have the authority to decide if we hold elections using the serialized ballot stock or the blank ballot stock? The answer is Clint can decide all by himself which paper, which stock we're going to use in the general. That's his decision. That's not the election board. It's not the election commission. It's certainly not the commissioner's court's decision. He is an independent authority over elections.
And the expert. One would hope.
Yeah, and the decision is his.
Yeah.
And that question was, that he answered that question before closed. He answered that question and emailed to me. He answered that question at the previous court meeting, because I said, hey, come here. And I had three constituents in my office and three staff members. And I said, what just happened up there, the election board meeting? I said, they authorized
the numbered ballots.
They authorized the purchasing of the stock, just the paper, just buy the paper. You are authorized to buy the paper with numbers on it. That's it. They didn't tell him he had to use that. And can they tell him that? Can they direct him to use numbered stock? And he said, no, ma'am. So I'm getting bombarded with inquiries about this. So I said, I'll put it back on the agenda. And just, hell, that should have been a 60-second,
you know. Conversation.
Yeah. Just confirm it publicly so these people can see it. It's memorialized for all to see that Mr. Ludwig can conduct that election the way he wants. And so you saw the, you know, 5-minute deal and Commissioner Ficus, you know, when the tote board button was pushed, you saw that he voted with myself and Commissioner Brooks, and the judge says, hey, is that how you want it to vote? And I'm like, no. Probably should ask him before you hit the, it's published. The motion, the vote has been processed. That's it. Robert's rule says you can come back and do it again. They could do it next week. But in that moment, no.
You can't just take it back.
You can't just take it back. I mean, we could be up there all day changing our votes on a variety. If you can't. There is a process, and that's your job to know that, Mr. Chair of a meeting. And that has happened 3 times before, and the last time he asked Commissioner Ficus, are you sure that's how you want to vote? I looked at the DA and I said, can he do that? can he do that? And he said, no, he's not supposed to. So this time when he did it, I was like, nope, just look up, look up, look at the board. We're done. Votes processed. And so that was a little dust up there. I mean, when my constituents tell me they want me to sit there and ignore improprieties, things, illegalities, perhaps that's when I'll sit there and do that. But no, people did not elect me to sit there and watch crazy things happen and just go, oh, I don't think that's supposed to happen. No.
Yeah.
I'm a voice. The people elect me to be a voice. And even if my constituents expected me to do that,
I don't think you would. I was about to say, I think that's not. As someone, conscientious person doing their job.
Yeah, that's not me.
Yeah, you also kind of, what is your overall take of the numbered ballots and the time being spent to do that? We also had the election integrity unit, and three people in their 70s voted twice was the finding. And you made a post on your comms about like the cost of having a lawyer in that space to be a part of that. Like, what's kind of your what do we need to know about elections in Tarrant County?
So, and I just read somebody's story. I don't know which paper it was. I just read it yesterday, and they interviewed Clint Ludwig, the elections administrator. Whose was that? Was that? I don't know.
I don't know. But we can search it and find it.
Yeah, but it said that he talked about, gosh, he talked about how much more trouble this would be. It's not necessary to do this. Our elections are already secure in Tarrant County. We do not have problems with election fraud in Tarrant County. Just can we stop the madness? And so we go and not me, but was the DA, Phil Sorrells, the sheriff, Bill Wayburn, and the county judge early on that decided to set up this elections integrity
unit,
whatever. And you know, you can't get out of them how many cases there are, you know. So I saw the article, like three old people
voted twice
maybe. But what they won't do is investigate that school board issue over in Mansfield, where you've got the candidate who is not registered to vote in Mansfield, barely lived there, wasn't registered in time to put his name on the ballot. He's on the ballot. The school board,
they're saying he's ineligible, but his name is still going to be on the ballot.
School board declared his ineligibility. They didn't declare his ineligibility before his name was officially cemented on the ballot. Just that bears some investigation over there. And I know the people, they called me. I said, call the elections integrity unit. Report this to them. And they can't get a call back. And so, you know, it that mess was investigated through the work of vigorous efforts of parents that kept it going. And thanks to the media, this guy finally got declared ineligible. But wouldn't that be great work, a great case for the Elections Integrity Unit? Mm-hmm. They wouldn't touch it. Why not? This would have been a big win for them. You know, they would have discovered that this guy was not eligible a long time ago. So it's a colossal waste. I have heard, and so I'm going to I'm going to agendize this for a briefing because it's been about a year since they set this thing up. We need an update. The public needs an update on the number of cases, how much staff time, salaries we've wasted on this unit.
Yeah.
The article came out talking about the numbered ballots and how much they cost and how much waste would have to happen. And so the headline of that article, I said, should have been, you know, County Commissioner's Court led by the county judge votes to throw away this much of taxpayer dollars.
That's what we're
fiscal responsibility is often, you know, something they're hanging their hat on. And I didn't think,
and
that
I don't know why people
believe that.
If people would pay attention, they would see that I am the fiscal conservative on that court. I just am. Not only do I question everything, not just questioning, I have solutions. You know what I'm saying? Because I hate people that complain.
Don't come with any solutions.
What you got?
Yeah.
I cannot stand it. So I'll own the word conservative. I am the most fiscally conservative member of that court. And you are not, just because you are clawing back ARPA dollars, because what you're doing is reassigning them to the sheriff, who's that sheriff's operation is just a myriad of problems. I'll come back and do a show just on that. How about that?
Yeah, we attended the town hall that you had, mm-hmm. Where you brought together the sheriff and staff and some activists in the community to talk about that. And again, I think that was an example of research that you did. And now you've shared with us today how hard of a time you had getting the information. Mm-hmm. So I think that those town halls are your way of informing the public and trying to get that information together.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I just need the public to pay attention. You know, county commissioner, when you go vote, so when I ran, I think the governor's race was the top of the ballot. County commissioner was the next to the last race on a long ballot. We have nearly a $1 billion budget that we manage. It's the next, the thing below it is constable. And so I'm standing at the polls with my sign. It's the next to the last race on the ballot.
Go to the bottom of the ballot.
And then I get in the position of going, woo, people really don't know the power and influence of a commissioner's court member. They really don't. And so when you're not paying attention, things happen like the Girls Inc.
Yep.
Club. That wasn't even our money. Y'all do know that.
Yeah, federal money that passed through.
Yeah, the state money, it just passed through us, been passing through us for 14, 15 years. Commissioner Ficus has been voting to support it for that long. And this year, he votes against it. It fails. So things.
There was a recent one with the racial equity that they're looking at with the Big Thought.
Yeah.
With the Creative Solutions Summer Program.
I saw that in the paper. I had no idea about it until this weekend. So I had no idea. And so it is. Y'all have to understand, if you look at it all, the attacks on social services for people who need them. Why? I call it a lot of things, but why? Why wouldn't you want to help the people that need it? Are we making America great again? Are we putting people in their place? What are we doing? Why did you take this job if you're not interested in helping citizens who can't help themselves? Pay very close attention to JPS, the budget, when they bring their budget to us for approval. If you paid attention last year, we lowered their tax rate. And I was the only one that voted against doing that because they haven't raised their tax rate in over 10 years. It's been flat. They stacked up enough money that will take care of, you know, cost overruns on the new hospital, the new mental health facility. I mean, it's a whole new thing over there.
And important stuff.
Very important. So we'll probably come after them again on and lower their tax rate. They can only take one or two more lowering of their tax rate, and it will put them in financial distress. And, you know, I tell my representatives on the board, we're setting you up for failure. We're setting that hospital up for failure. And then we'll say the president and CEO
didn't do a good job.
Fiduciary and did not do a good job. Right now, she's stacked. I mean, she's got dollars just stacked up to take care of any cost overruns, change orders, all that stuff during construction. And then when things are done, she can pay to employ people
to run all
to do the work. But last year, and I'll wrap up here on JPS, so all these public speakers from Southlake came to talk about cutting JPS's tax rate. But in there, they talked about lowering the president and CEO's salary. It's like, where'd that come from? We don't decide that anyway. That's what her board does.
There's a lot of presidents and CEOs of other hospitals that are making more money than she is. And it seems very interesting that she was the target of all of that.
Yeah. Black female.
Yeah.
I'm a black female, you know. And the thing the other day with the be quiet, sit down, and listen, that was not his first time telling me to essentially, I've got my air quote fingers up, to shut up. He did that in a few months back. We were discussing tech share. Court, this incredibly wasteful software that this county has spent like $65 million on.
Wow.
And it does not work. So we were in a work session and he said something about, well, you're still going on. He essentially was telling me to be quiet. And I said, you will not tell me to be quiet. I have as much authority as you, 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 and you. So that the Tuesday was not the first time. He frequently, you know, tries to cut me off just by, you know, interrupting. I cannot be shut up. And, you know, some of the media ask about decorum. So let me be very clear. If he attempts to do that again, I will respond again because I will not sit there under the guise of decorum and be spoken to that way. So I'm supposed to behave. You want me to behave? Let this cat talk to me any way he wants to, and I'm just supposed to sit there. That is never happening. Do I think that all of it looks you know, like seventh grade student council stuff. Yes, it does. It is not a good look. But I'll be damned if somebody thinks they can get away with directing me to be quiet, sit there, and listen to me. And really, I was responding to his questions, and he was interrupting me. I was just continuing to answer the question. So not here for fireworks. I've got some clear issues that I'm interested in advancing. I would love to lower our jail population. It is doable. Sheriff's Department operations needs to be cleaned up. We have wasted so much money. We've brought in an outside recruiting firm. We've paid them $38,000 for a 3-month contract. They hired
three people,
about three detention officers. That's a waste. That's a do you understand? That's a waste. Right now, we've hired a consultant. He's there an 18-month gig. We pay him $200,000 a year for this 18-month gig to just go in, look at all sheriff's department operations. Hell, we have an elected sheriff who gets paid that much to run. So we just brought in a babysitter for him to the tune of $200,000. That is a waste. Do you understand? We have an elected. You were elected because you're supposed to know how to run your sheriff's office. Got lawsuits out the wazoo from the sheriff's office, all the way from employment to backing over people's mailbox. I mean, just it's like stop. It's just money.
One of the things
and
you're
then
a
that
part of-
that $40 million contract. We were paying to Garza County. Just the ridiculousness of it all. And so I was the architect, you know, I've been hammering away on that for many, many months, and they are sick of me. But when Garza County jail, where our inmates are housed, failed, the jail standards inspection in six areas, that gave me an opportunity to swoop in there and say, all right, this is what we're doing. We're going to keep giving these cats $40 million to
not meet standards.
Not meet standards. That's horrible. So was I shocked when there was agreement that we could sever that contract? I was, but I was also happy. So Sheriff's Department's doing Sheriff's Department facilities, the judiciary, they're working some magic to clear up some things so that we can get those folks back here by September. And I started in my role not intending to start to go after this, but this criminal courts software, TechShare Court, the county somewhere, Judge Whitley 12 years ago thought that the county could develop its own software. And 12 years later, the stuff had not been launched. 12 years and $65 million later. So that was the first thing I ended up addressing. It wasn't the first. I knew very little about it before I came into office. It was right when I got elected. I was looking at stuff, and I went, what is this? What's TechShare Court? And so $65 million in taxpayer money. They spent over 11 years. Now it's 12. 11 years, and it had not been implemented. Like, it, no software development takes that long. And so I began asking questions about it. And they said, okay, it's ready to implement. Well, the district clerk was like, no. Mr. Wilder was like, I don't think so. And the district clerk, or the clerk, was like, yeah, because it was kind of her baby. And when it was launched, boy, did my inbox fill up from county court clerks, jail staff, everybody saying, this stuff does not work. We're keeping people in after they've been released for 3 or 4 days. Nothing was connecting. It wasn't working. We're letting people out that shouldn't be let out. The defense bar was up in arms. And all of them still are. The patches and plugins, it's just a mess.
Well, you'd think that software from 12 years ago would have needed a lot of updates between then and now. So there's no way that anything that...
I started this thing off talking about the inefficiencies. This place is very interesting. It is. And so I don't know if one person can...
Fix it all.
You can
bring it to light.
I can bring it to light.
Commissioner Simmons, we appreciate you coming to the 817 podcast and being a light for all of us. And we've really been inspired by the work you've already done in your short time up there. You've done a lot. And you've told all of our listeners to flash a light to what continues to be inefficient, ineffective, and the things that you're trying to keep the rest of the county accountable for. Any last minute kind of things as you go off to your next meeting and continue to do what you do, any kind of last minute things you would like us to know about the county and what's kind of to come from your office and to?
Well, if you like how things are going, then okay. But if you don't, and you won't if you pay attention, I have to figure
out.
That
is the theme of this pod. Yeah. Yes. Pay attention.
I have to figure out another way to say pay attention. But we meet first and third Tuesdays. And if you can't come down, because we meet at 10 a.m., I think my first meeting, I said, we need to consider having at least one meeting at night. But we meet at 10 a.m. You can watch it on our Tarrant County YouTube channel. And, you know, our agendas come out the Friday before the Tuesday on our website. Click on that thing. Look at it. See if there's anything of interest to you. I am always accessible. I think my cell phone's out there, still out there from being NAACP president, so everybody has it. Let me know what concerns you, and I'll bring it up. I'll agendize it. I'll get the data, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I'll bring it up. If you want a change, you know, people that listen to your podcast probably vote. Okay?
We hope so.
May 4th, guys.
But there are thousands upon thousands of registered voters that do not vote. And so it does me no good to tell your listeners to go vote. They need to go and grab people and drag them to the polls. You just do.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I love it. Yeah, it's been really great to have you. And guys, continue to listen and support. You can also, we'll put your guys' Instagrams in our show notes. So please follow. They keep it daily. I mean, they're updating it a lot. You guys are always making moves, doing things. So great person to follow to stay informed of what's happening there. Thank you again, Commissioner, for being a part of the show.
Thank you.
All right, so it's time to move into wins and losses. We start with our losses so that we can end on a win. And what is your loss?
So my loss hopefully is not going to continue to be a loss in the future, but there was news this week that the TNP station parking lot redevelopment has been paused after the Austin developer pulled out. So this development has had its challenges over the years. There's been a couple of developers that have come in, and this is now another developer that has decided to not move forward with it. So that's my loss for the week. I'm hoping that Trinity Metro, who's the owner of this property, can find development partners in the future. I know there's TIF money from Near Southside Inc. that is supporting this redevelopment, and hopefully it will happen in the future, because mixed-use development around a transit center is good, solid development with a return on investment. And I don't know why this developer decided not to move forward with it, but hopefully in the future we will have more than just a surface parking lot behind our train station on Vickery Boulevard.
My loss is a story about venture capital activity in Dallas-Fort Worth. It falls to the lowest level in a decade. Venture capitalist activity in Dallas-Fort Worth. Local startups have raised $192 million across 28 deals in the first quarter. So to give you an example, that number of deals was the lowest for any quarter in the report. It goes back to 2014. On a year-over-year basis, the number of deals fell 50% from 56 in the first quarter of 2023, while funding declined 43%. So this is just like, I guess, just a loss, because when I look at, we look at innovation and we just look at jobs, even though Texas is really booming with getting a lot of tech jobs, a lot of that's happening in Austin, a lot of that's happening in Frisco. Houston, some, San Antonio, some, Fort Worth, I think, is just really, I just don't know how our capital and how we participate. Granted, this is a Metroplex deal, but I also just think this just shows you, like, it's just a really hard time right now to think about, like, technical innovation and startups. Usually, in times, I think people are just grooving with times after the pandemic. I think there's not as much movement just like high interest loans to take risk, and just capital's really on ice for everything that's not artificial intelligence. And because I don't think those are spaces that the Metroplex is known for, we're just having very low investments. And so for people who have ideas or startups in this area, you know, we can't really support them if there's not investors or people doing important stuff. I had like several other losses.
I know. When we started this whole thing, you said you thought you were going to have double losses and no wins.
Yeah. You know, Texas has more white supremacist incidents last year than most of the U.S. Like, that's another one I could have dove into. But I decided to, you know, change it up. I feel like it's been a while since I've talked about startups and the economy. So I used that. There's a ton we could talk about losses. But we can go into wins.
So my win is I attended the 20th annual Southwest Rail Conference this past week. It was hosted by the Texas Rail Advocates, and it was held in Hearst, which was not served by transit. Unfortunately, I had to drive there. They did, in the instructions, let us know that we could take TexRail to the nearby North Richland Hill station, but then that would require some kind of rideshare ride to get to the convention center. But at this conference was a speaker that I was really excited to listen to, and his name is Andy Byford, and he has recently been hired by Amtrak to head up their high-speed rail division. And so we'll put in the show notes a KERA article that talks about the Southwest Rail Conference and the possibility of high-speed rail or a bullet train coming to Texas. So I just was surrounded by other people who are rail advocates and are excited about rail. They talked about both passenger rail and freight. And so I nerded out about rail for 2 days.
Yeah. And I sent you an article about how Biden, when the prime minister of Japan came and hung out with Biden, they talked about rail and,
yep,
you know, like,
so
how to do
the
that
takeaway from the conference was basically the time is now. And while there's been people advocating for more regional rail and connecting cities in Texas by rail, that there's more folks kind of on board for that now. There's been in the past concern about acquisition of land and the use of eminent domain and all of those things. But I think now that Amtrak has taken an interest in this, there's an organization called Texas Central who's done a lot of the legwork on high-speed rail between Houston and the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We always want to keep in mind trying to keep that connection to Fort Worth. And so I just think that it'll be exciting. I had never met Andy Byford before, but apparently he was in New York for a while, and he got the moniker Rail Daddy.
Rail Daddy.
Yes.
Nice.
So hopefully can deliver. Everybody seemed very excited.
If he delivers, I'll call him Rail Daddy too. No diddy. But here we go. So I'm going to talk about, man, you're right. There was like several losses that I could have also brought up. I'm trying to find a win. My win is us. That's what I'll go. For all of you who are listening to this pod still to the very end, you know, Ann and I have been doing this for a long time, but when I edit this podcast and I see all the guests that we have from different diverse backgrounds, I look at me and Ann, you know, someone asked me what I was thankful for. And I was like, I'm thankful that I get to hang out with a person who are probably like, we would never cross paths without the podcast. I guess in Fort Worth, we're small enough, but like generationally, we're different, ethnically, nationally, gender, how we grew up. And every week we get to come together and do a podcast. And I just feel like most people with podcasts, they're two white guys or they're two
white women.
Two white women or two ethnic groups complaining about the world. And it's just like the fact that we could do a pod together and just to curate something like this is a win, I think, special for Fort Worth. And so I just ask you guys to make sure you subscribe, make sure you tell a friend. We really keep this organic and bootstrapped because we do talk a lot about a lot of stuff. So the only way this grows is by people who know the DL tell other people about what's happening. And so we're not trying to get in the crossfires of all the crazy stuff that happens out there. So find the right people. Tell them about this podcast. And really, I think it's something special that's happening. And we're going to continue to try to deliver shows like we just did where we had County Commissioner Lisa Simmons, which she was great.
I'm really grateful for this opportunity as well. And I, you know, am looking forward to doing this every week. I think we're two people that really care about our community and want other people to care as well. And so I appreciate this platform to be able to continue to do that.
There you guys go. We ended on Kumbaya. So here we go. Have a great week. And we'll see you next time on the 817 podcast. Yeah. Follow us.